the radical left, the Marxists, the anarchists, the agitators, the looters, and people who, in many instances, have absolutely no clue what they are doing.
Welcome to What Radicalized You, a podcast of stories and experiences that have shaped people's ideas about our world and the way society should function.
My name is Kate Pritzker. I'm a journalist. I work for a media outlet called Breakthrough News. We, you know, are an independent, socialist, movement-minded media network, and we just started a year ago. And I'm a socialist. I'm a socialist organizer with the Party for Socialism and Liberation. I've been part of the PSL for about 3.5 years now, long before Breakthrough News started. I'm 24 years old. I live in Brooklyn, New York. It's a very important question, and I think it's something that is important to understand about our friends, about people we organize with, about people we don't know. I think it's an important question because, you know, first and foremost, socialism is more popular now, and, you know, radical ideas are more popular now than they have been since, I'd say, like the 1960s or 70s. And it's important to understand that not everyone has the same sort of radicalization story, so to speak. And I think that's really important to understand. And, you know, I say that coming from a personal place. I'm going to get into this a little more, but everyone arrives at these conclusions or comes to these truths in a different way. And I think it's very important that we understand that people come from different backgrounds. They may have had previous views that they renounce today and so on and so forth. But it's important that, above all things, we should care about the fact that people have, you know, arrived to the conclusions they've arrived to. So I think it's great that you're sort of documenting all these different people's experiences becoming radicalized. For me personally, I'm a Marxist, and that means that in order to understand things, as Marxists, we study the history of a thing. If you want to understand the history of the United States, you got to study the history of the United States. If you want to understand the history of the French Revolution, you have to study feudalism in Europe and France and whatnot. And similarly, if you want to understand me and why I was radicalized, you have to study the sort of history of me. I grew up in Connecticut, in Fairfield County. And anyone that's from there knows, you know, this is a very wealthy place. It's one of the wealthiest places in America. You know, when I was growing up, obviously, I grew up there my whole life. And when I was growing up there, I didn't know anything about economies or, you know, anything like that. But most of the people that live there, I mean, you know, they commute. There's a commuter line that goes from Connecticut and drops people off in Manhattan. And, you know, a lot of people from my town, they worked in finance, they worked on Wall Street, they worked in big consulting firms, and then they would go back home to their families. So that's really where I came from. And growing up, I never really left this small town I lived in, Weston, Connecticut. And that was really my whole world. But my first sort of political thoughts, you know, when I was in school, I was always interested in what was happening in the country. I didn't know a lot, but my dad was like a progressive Democrat, I guess you could say. My mom wasn't super political at the time, but my dad was very interested in politics. And he always watched MSNBC and NPR, which, you know, I really can't stand those two outlets. But I was exposed to that every single day of my life. Every time, there was nothing else played in the car besides NPR. And every night at dinner, we watched MSNBC together as a family. So, you know, from an early age, I watched a lot of, you know, different political coverage and whatnot. And that always got me asking questions about what's wrong in this country. You know, how can things be improved? And I remember the first time I had an inkling of socialism was when I was in the car with my dad in like seventh grade. And I just asked him, hey, Dad, why don't we just give everyone the same amount of money? Or why doesn't the government just give people money? And he was like, well, that would be socialism. And socialism, while it looks great on paper, it's never actually worked in real life. And, you know, that kind of ended the debate for me. When, you know, when dad tells you something doesn't work, I love my dad. He's a smart guy and I looked up to him a lot. So I was like, okay, that must be true. Socialism doesn't work. But, you know, I still never lost my interest in politics, and I was always frustrated with the sort of two-party system. I didn't know that there was anything outside of the two-party system until I was in high school. I was just on the bus one day, and my friend was like, hey, Kay, like, this was in 2012, and he was like, or 2011, really, and he was like, who do you want to win this, like, upcoming presidential election? And I was like, well, I want Obama to win. I want Barack Obama to win. And he was like, why? And I was like, you know, I really don't know. It was really because my dad supported Obama. And, you know, our town was all Democrats with a capital D, very blue area. He was like, well, you know, I support Ron Paul. And I was like, who's that? He's a libertarian candidate. He ran in the 2008 and 2012 Republican primaries. And he was sort of like, he was like an alternative candidate. I mean, he was a libertarian, really, in the truest sense of the word. And what drew me in, one of the first Ron Paul videos I saw was this video where he was talking about the Iraq war. And he was saying that what we're doing to Iraq is not just disgusting and not just totally against the will of the American people, a waste of tax money, but it's an affront to the freedom of the Iraqi people. And, you know, in 2012, 2008, 2012, it was clear that the U.S. was losing the war. I mean, the Iraqi resistance, they would publish these videos of random people just sniping American soldiers in the streets, you know, killing them on the spot. There were planes dumping flag-draped coffins, you know, back in the United States by the planeful. And I, you know, this was a huge sort of politicizing moment for me, this learning that there was an anti-war candidate, because there were no anti-war candidates really running in the presidential race besides Ron Paul. And Ron Paul was drawing massive crowds. He was running against Mitt Romney for the Republican nomination, and Mitt Romney's crowds were like tiny. It was like a few hundred people. But Ron Paul was drawing thousands of people, and not just thousands of random people. A lot of them were younger people. They were, you know, university students. And his candidacy got me thinking about things that I had never thought about before. I didn't realize that you could be anti-war. I didn't realize that there were people outside of the two-party system. Although he was running as a Republican, you know, many of his supporters and followers wouldn't identify with the Republican Party, because what Ron Paul was really pointing out was that the status quo in this country wasn't working, and that there was, not only was it not working, that there were massive problems of poverty and corruption, endless war. Corruption in terms of the banking system getting bailed out in 2008. You know, this was after that. The mass surveillance of the American people. For the first time in my life, I really felt like I was starting to see the United States for what it was, for what the mainstream media doesn't talk about on TV, which is the fact that our government is run by elites who don't care about average people. So I was a libertarian for, you know, a few years of my life in high school, and I became very passionately political, and I railed against the wars and the surveillance and the fact that the U.S. government was bailing out all these banks and supporting all these corporations. Of course, the Obama administration was full of all of these lobbyists and whatnot. But the only sort of flaw that I began to see in my sort of worldview, this libertarian worldview, is that libertarianism says that all of the problems in the world, of which there were many that, you know, libertarians raise, there are so many problems. It would attribute all these things to big government, yes, but, you know, libertarians would say things like, oh, Obama doesn't know what he's doing, or Congress doesn't know what it's doing. They keep increasing the size of government, and they keep embarking on these wars which do nothing for our country. In fact, they not only do that, they weaken our country, and they also weaken other countries. They kill hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. They're an awful thing. They attribute all these mistaken policies to this sort of naivety in politicians, that they're making the wrong choices and that they don't know what they're doing. Or, you know, they say, oh, Obama was mistaken to bail out the banks. That was a mistaken policy, and he's, you know, an idiot. He doesn't know what he's doing. But what I came to realize over time, the more I realized how flawed this society was, the more I realized this is not because politicians don't understand economics, or they don't understand diplomacy, or they don't understand this or that. It's that they do understand it. They understand it very well. And it is the intended nature of the system. In fact, this is exactly how the system is supposed to work. This is why you hear a lot of libertarians saying, oh, well, you know, what we have isn't real capitalism, it's crony capitalism. It is real capitalism. To say it's crony capitalism is to say that the people in power don't know what they're doing, or that they don't understand where they stand on things, and they're making all these mistakes. But the reality is, our country is being run by people who are very intelligent and people who are very intentional in what they do. You know, Obama didn't choose to bail out the banks because it was a stupid policy. He didn't understand economics, or he didn't understand the ramifications of that decision. He did it because most of his top campaign donations came from banks. And this wasn't like a change that happened overnight. And I think a lot of people, when you ask them what radicalized you, they attribute it to like one moment. But it was really, you know, me spending a lot of time on the internet. I didn't have a lot of friends when I was younger, and I wasn't super close to my family, I would say. I spent a lot of time just reading about politics on the internet, and I would debate with people on the internet, on Facebook and stuff. I would debate with socialists, and that's actually how I really first got introduced to socialism. And it was over maybe the course of 2 years that they eventually made me realize, you know, what I just explained, that the system is not mistakenly creating this elite parasitic class of billionaires. That's what it's designed to do, and that it's a very intentional thing. That was a sort of one of the big turning points. And when I entered college, I was like, okay, I'm a socialist. I don't really know what that means, but I know I'm opposed to capitalism. I didn't really get into a whole lot of like the intellectualism that you see on social media nowadays. I was really just interested in organizing for justice, whatever that meant. And when I went to college, I went to George Washington University in DC. I began organizing with the student worker sort of alliance. It was sort of allied with people who were working in the dining halls and people who were like the cleaning staff. They were the custodial staff of the school. And, you know, I was very active in that sort of group. And I was also very active on the issue of Palestine. I think this is sort of the second turning point. When I was a libertarian, I was also very supportive of the Palestinians. That's one thing I've really never wavered on because, you know, I mean, I don't need to explain that. What Israel's doing to the Palestinians is genocide. But I was very active on the issue in college. And, you know, there were a lot of sort of pro-Israel people involved. And when I say I was very active, I mean, people would literally ask me if I was actually a student at GW because I didn't attend class so much. I skipped a lot of my classes because I was, the only thing I really cared about was politics and was organizing against war and organizing against capitalism. And, you know, I was in Students for Justice in Palestine. I was one of the sort of like leaders, I guess you could say, and I was tasked my junior year of college with doing the research for a divestment bill. For those that don't know, you know, there's this large international movement called Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS. It's called the BDS movement, and it's to sort of boycott Israeli products, to encourage large institutions to divest from Israeli apartheid, and to sanction Israel ultimately for violating international law and committing crimes against humanity. But I was tasked with conducting the research into different U.S. companies that were invested in Israeli apartheid. So like Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, United Technologies, obviously they build weapons for the IDF. But also things like Motorola, they, you know, provide this technology that is used for biometric ID scans at these checkpoints. They basically fingerprint and track Palestinians because being Palestinian is a crime in occupied Palestine. So I poured my life into this research. I mean, I spent like a month researching this every single day. And over the course of that period, you know, one thing that really dawned on me, this was around 2016, 2017. I really started to realize, or it really just became so unavoidably obvious to me, that Israeli apartheid and the Israeli, you know, ethnic cleansing of Palestine is not possible without U.S. support. And that's not something I didn't know, but researching how impossible this whole thing was, how impossible Israeli apartheid was without the support of the U.S., it really dawned on me doing this research, and it made me evaluate the U.S.'s relationship, not just with Israel and the Palestinians, but really with the whole world. For the longest time, even when I was a libertarian, you know, even in high school, I read a lot about how the U.S. lied to go to war, how it lied to go to war in Vietnam, how it lied to go to war with Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya. And when I was in college sort of doing this research, Donald Trump was president. He was newly president. And he was bombing Syria and he was threatening nuclear war against North Korea. And I was very active on the Palestine front, but I would tell my friends involved in the movement for Palestine, I was like, hey, the same way they lie about Palestinians being terrorists and the same way they justify all the crimes against humanity against Palestine, the U.S. is doing the same thing to Syria and North Korea. Like, they're making stuff up about Syria and they're making stuff up about North Korea. And the more I just started to look into it, you know, the more I realized how deeply I'd been lied to. You know, it's something you learn over time. I mean, even when I was, you know, a libertarian, I realized what a fraud the bailouts were. I realized what a fraud the surveillance state was and the war on drugs. But the more I became politicized, I realized that the U.S. discourse on Palestine was a lie. And then I started to realize that every U.S. war is a lie, and that every U.S. war is a war for money and for plunder. I looked into Syria, for example. I looked at the areas of Syria that the U.S. had troops sort of occupying the country, and it's in the northeast, which is where 90% of Syria's oil is. You know, also the Syrians support the Palestinians, and the U.S. doesn't want that. I also noticed that they were lying about these chemical attacks. They were lying about the use of chemical weapons in Syria. You know, I'm not going to go further into that, but I think I got to a place where I started to realize how much we were being lied to, not just in the past, but in the present as well. And it's not something you can unsee. It's not something you can unthink. Like, the United States has over 1,000 military bases all across the world. Most people don't have national sovereignty. Like, the Syrians don't have national sovereignty. They can vote for president, they can vote for whoever, but it doesn't matter if this foreign power that they have no say in, you know, the U.S. political system, can just choose to bomb and occupy their country whenever they want. I can't live with that. I pay taxes to this country. I live here. This is what the government is saying it's doing in our name for our security. How could I live? How could I wake up in the morning or go to sleep at night knowing that people are being killed in my name? I don't want any Syrian to think that I approve of this. I want them to realize that no one in this country actually approves of the U.S. bombing of Syria or any other country for that matter. And the people of the United States have no interest in this either. The people of the United States, they don't benefit from this in any way. I mean, there's so much inequality and poverty in this country. So I kind of became obsessed with understanding U.S. imperialism and U.S. militarism. And I was in a very, I guess, pessimistic sort of place. Like, all I could see was like, oh, U.S. is bombing this country. It's occupying this country. The wealthiest 1% in this country control more resources than however many number of people. No one has healthcare. No one has, you know, properly funded education here. And I would read about, oh, the U.S. killed 10% of the Philippines population. They killed 30% of the Korean population. It's very disheartening to hear all of that. What changed things really for me was meeting the Party for Socialism and Liberation. My friends and I in college, who were all sort of like beginning to see that the U.S. was an empire. It wasn't just a random country. It's really the country that controls the entire world. We were all sort of going through this, and one of my friends told me that she had gone to a study group held by the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and she was like, you should check it out. And I did, and I never left. And the reason this was so pivotal for me is because it's one thing to understand that the United States and capitalism and endless war and all these things are horrible for not just for Americans and not just for people in this country, but for the whole world. It also made me realize that there's an alternative, and that really the biggest lie that we're taught in American schools is that socialism didn't work. And I guess, you know, I'm sorry to be long-winded, but all of these lies that I began to sort of uncover, I think all culminated in this one big lie, which is that socialism has never worked and that capitalism is the best way to organize society. I realized that the banker bailouts, you know, that I talked about way back in 2008, the surveillance system, the invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan, all of this, the bombing of Syria, the sanctions against the DPRK and Venezuela and Cuba, all of this, all of it was designed to do one thing, which is to preserve the hegemony, to preserve the rule of an elite 1% parasitic class, which rakes in millions and billions of dollars, doing nothing but owning financial assets, doing nothing but owning companies, and owning all the valuable resources in the world. And the last thing they wanted, the last thing they want is for people to realize that not only have people in the past organized societies, which are the opposite, where people come before profit, where profit isn't the sort of driving force of society. Not only did those societies exist, but they thrived. And that is what blew my mind. That is what blew my mind, was learning about the massive achievements in socialist countries, despite what the United States put them through. You know, you think about the Korean War, it wasn't just because the US hated Koreans. They were trying to stop the development of a socialist country. The U.S. doesn't blockade Cuba just because they hate Cubans or they hate Latino people. They're doing it to crush a socialist revolution, to make it look unsuccessful and to make it look like a failure. When I learned about the fact that the Soviet Union, which was born in 1917, almost destroyed by the Nazi war machine from 1941 to 1945, this country, which was an agrarian, backward society before the Bolshevik Revolution, turned itself into a world superpower by 1945. Its country had been destroyed during the Second World War, and then 10 years later, they're the first country to put a ship in space, Sputnik, the Soviet spaceship. How is it possible that socialism was a failure if the Soviets won the space race? How is it possible that the socialism was a failure? How could they possibly have put the first person in space? How is it possible that socialism is a failure if Cuba is inventing cancer-ending drugs? How is it possible that socialism is a failure, like they say it was, if China, which was a backwards, feudal, imperialized country in 1949, in 1948, how could they say socialism was a failure if China today has ended absolute poverty in its country completely? And the more I started to look into it, I was like, not only is socialism not a failure, they're trying to hide this information from us. And that enraged me. Where I went to school in Washington, D.C., it's like, the reason I even went there, it's like, they tell you Washington, D.C. is where you can go to make change. And Washington, D.C. is, you know, it's where people who are motivated to do public service go to change the country. Washington, D.C. is, it's a tale of two cities. And it's divided along not just racial lines, but geographic lines. It used to be called Chocolate City because it was a black city. And that has been erased in the last 20 years because of capitalism. You can be in Washington, D.C., in the District of Columbia, which is what we say the government side is. Like, it's the northwest quadrant of Washington, D.C. You can be there. You'll see people walking around in, like, $1,000 suits and, like, they're having brunch and all this. You go 2 miles across the city and you see absolute poverty. You see people who are addicted to drugs. There are no job prospects. There are people with no healthcare. It's absolute poverty. And that really is why this was so impactful on me, is because understanding that all of these things, which I couldn't explain before in my life, the endless wars, the banker bailouts, all of these things, to understand finally that these things happen because they, meaning the capitalists, the rich, they need to keep people poor. People have to be poor in order for them to be rich. And the reason all these horrible things in the world were happening is because a group of small people, a handful of people, the 1%, whatever you want to call them, were living high and fancy off of the backs, off of the suffering of people, not just in my city, but people all around the world. I don't want to live in that society. No one should want to live in that society, especially when we know that we can meet everyone's needs on the planet if we were to organize production in a centralized way where there is no profit, where people don't take the cream off the top, where in order for someone to have a house, someone else has to profit. In order for someone to have a loaf of bread, someone has to profit. We need to cut that cream off the top out completely and give it back to the people. We have the means to provide a house, a job, clothes, food, clean water to everyone on the planet. But we don't do it because there's a handful of people that have an interest in being infinitely wealthy, and they're willing to sacrifice the lives of everyone else to maintain this lifestyle, and I don't want to live in that society. My own life will only be a half-life. I will only know half of my human potential. I'll only live this sort of dystopic and sick. I'll only live in this sort of sick society unless we do something to change it. So I always kind of felt, even when I was first getting politicized, I always kind of felt like my life, the purpose of my life was to change the world. And you know, I don't mean to say that in some kind of like, I think everyone's purpose in life should be to change this, because nobody's benefiting from this society. Everyone's suffering except a handful of people. And I think we all have an interest in changing this. And me realizing that is just, I think, one of millions of stories. When I first started organizing in college, a lot of people would make fun of me because, you know, they knew I used to be a libertarian. And I think deep down, most people want the best for the most people. Most people want to see change. Most people don't like the status quo and they want to see change. But the way you sort of conceptualize, the way you sort of like understand society, the way you see society and the way you understand how things change, that is completely related to your upbringing, your surroundings. You know, the reason I became a libertarian is because there were no socialists where I lived. But, you know, I consider it a very important part of my political development, because without being a libertarian first, I wouldn't have realized that I was in opposition to something else, which was socialism. And through that opposition, I realized that being a libertarian, that was incorrect. Like, I had incorrect views of the world. I think there's a sort of attitude on the left or among progressive or radical people that you're supposed to be perfect. Like, you're supposed to be this perfect person already, or that you're supposed to have all the correct ideas. And that people with the wrong idea, that people with incorrect ideas, or people who, you know, say something wrong or do something wrong, that they're bad people. And I really want people to realize that this is not just a childish, an untrue way to see things. It's also incredibly counterproductive. I mean, if you consider yourself someone that wants progressive change, that wants people to come before profit, you also have to understand that this country was built. The purpose of this country, the reason it was founded and the way it was built, was to funnel wealth to an extremely small handful of people. And that's a constant throughout U.S. history. That's the purpose of the U.S. system when the Declaration of Independence was signed, and that still remains the purpose of our society today, to funnel wealth to the richest people in our society at the expense of everyone else. If you live in a society like that, everything in that society will reflect those ideals. Everything in that society will encourage greed, and it'll encourage this whole attitude of mine, 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 gimme, gimme, gimme. So if you come across someone who says things like, oh, you know, well, I think like we've never had real capitalism, and like I don't think capitalism, or whatever they might say, whoever you come across, please don't treat them like they're a bad person. They were raised in a bad system. They were lied to, because the system depends on lies to perpetuate its existence. And if you think of yourself as someone that's conscious, if you think of yourself as someone that's informed, it's your job to not only show people that they're being lied to, like, we want people to know that they're being lied to. We should never want people to live in this sort of ignorance. But also understand that deep down, we're all human. Like, not only do we always make mistakes, but I really do believe most people want what's good for society. And you need to bring that out in people. You need to show them that there is another way of organizing things. It's really this sort of like intellectualism and this mentality of like trying to prove to everyone that oh, you know, I'm so smart and I know all this, but also this idea that being a radical means you have to put other people down, and that you have to tell people, you have to be exclusionary, and you have to be the gatekeeper of like who's radical and who's not. You know what the most radical thing is? To me, the most radical thing you can do is to convince people that we can change society. People have to remember, what we're up against is way more threatening and daunting and dangerous than whatever, you know, mistaken idea that your comrade has. All this infighting over silly things about, are you this ideology or are you that ideology? Like, there's all these small debates over stupid issues. And it's like, hey, the US is like arming the Saudi military to like genocide Yemen. The US is bombing Syria illegally. The US is blockading Cuba and cutting it off from all outside resources in Venezuela. Who cares what, you know, such and such person said about this, you know, small ideological difference? We're literally being left for dead in this COVID pandemic. I mean, people are literally being told, we can't help you. We can't give you what you need. You have to risk dying at your workplace to get by. So, you know, I want people to remember, because I really do think we're on the brink of something amazing. I want people to remember going forward that there will be fights, there will be disagreements, you know, you don't have to love everyone. But let's all remember why we got into this in the first place. We're going up against the biggest empire, the most inhumane, cruel, most genocidal empire in human history. This is going to take all of us. It's going to take everyone's effort, and we need to see everyone as a potential collaborator and as a potential comrade in this fight. So, you know, never write anyone off, because I wouldn't be here if someone wrote me off.